Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
So we are in the Parsha Chukat, and I'm reading on a triennial cycle. We are at the end of this interesting Parsha. At the beginning of the Parsha, we get the death of Miriam, and we get this whole idea that with the death of Miriam, immediately after it says that Miriam died and was buried, it says, "V'lo hayamayim la'eda," and there wasn't water for the Eda, for the community. So this is an engraved invitation for the rabbis. Right? If it says Miriam died and was buried, and the very next sentence is there was no water for the people and they complained, it must mean what? That she somehow was the cause of there being enough water. Because obviously they're tied. Right? Because why would that sentence immediately follow the other one? So for the rabbis, they start there with, okay, so Miriam had something to do with the water, and once she died, it was gone. And then they read back, all the way back to the song at the sea, where it says that Miriam called to them, and they answered. And most of us reading the pshat, reading on the just regular surface level, would mean she called to the people, and the people answered. But the rabbis, needing a proof text for this idea of Miriam providing water, say, don't read, she called to the people and they answered. Rather, because mayim is a plural word, a plural singular. Remember what we talked about, a plural singular? Like face, panim, it's plural, but it's a singular. So don't read, she called to the people, but she called to them, meaning the waters. And they answered. And this is the proof that Miriam, in fact, was the provider of the water in the desert. So this is how the rabbis read Torah, not just at the regular level that you would translate, like the pshat, the surface level, but they read Torah like a love letter. Why a comma and not a dash here? Why dearest Amy, right? Instead of dear Rabbi Bernstein. What, you know, like, every single thing.
It's like reading every letter in an email.
It's like reading nuance and tone into an email.
Trying
to extract from an email what is really going on. What are they thinking? What are they feeling? What do they mean? Right? So the rabbis read Torah as a love letter, and they play with Torah. So what we don't often understand is how playful, actually, Chazal were, our sages. They were very playful. Some of what they do is very tongue-in-cheek. Like, we read it, you know, like this, but they played a lot. This was their game. Torah was their life and their game. So the way some kids can rattle off stats, you know, about their favorite team and favorite players, I'm just like, how are you engaged with this material enough to know that, right? You know, that body of knowledge. They know every single fact and nuance, and you're right. So it's a similar kind of thing. This is what the rabbis spent their time on and spent their time with. So
the expression, a Talmud Chacham, says somebody who is gifted in reading these or interpreting.
Exactly. A Talmud Chacham, right? A student who is truly bright at this. And that was how you won. You know, you won by having the cleverest interpretation, the cleverest answer, the cleverest matching of, if it says the water is in Miriam here, and then it must mean over here, right? And the more you can do that, the greater an artist you are, right, at working with this amazing body of holy literature.
So here are two more waters.
Here are two more waters.
From Miriam.
Speak.
She listened to God and told her parents to get back and have sexual relations, and the the developing fetus in the womb is surrounded by water. That's one. Two, she watched by the side of the riverbank as Moses's little raft went sailing down. Since those are exclusively female things, we have to assume the rabbis didn't
think of that.
Think of them.
I don't know. I mean, I think the whole Exodus narrative counts on our knowledge of the waters of birth. Because I think passing through the bloody portal and then finally through the oat split waters, I think you cannot but read that as a birth metaphor.
Okay.
It's the birth of the people, right? They go from being a people to the beginnings of being a nation, right? Of being, I mean, they're kind of riffraff, and then they become a people. That's the birth canal. So, I mean, I think actually that story is dependent on reading the waters as the waters of birth and of life and of life-giving. But of course, I think it's women who have taken the story of Miriam and her connection to water further, right? You know, it's women who have really taken that whole idea and now in our time have made it into a whole ritual that attends both healing services, girl namings, as well as the Kos Miriam, the Miriam's cup that we have at Seder.
I'm just curious, when you talk about that in relation to birth, do the Orthodox also see that or no, because it has to do with vaginas?
So do they see it?
Do they acknowledge
yes,
it?
I think they do.
Talk about it?
I think they acknowledge it and... and they focus on the history of it.
Okay.
We focus on the symbolism of it.
Okay.
Because we read this non-fundamentally.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't read that story for the history of the event.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The symbolism of that story is what continues to move me,
yeah.
Not the historicity.
I have a question. What is your thought with Miriam and Mayim being supposedly related to separated by a race? What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's just an interesting business. This Maryam, Mar meaning bitter, Yam meaning sea. The bitter sea is an odd name for a heroine, but other people trace the root of her name to other origins. Marom, like, you know, lifted up, exalted. But there's something else I can't remember though that some people want to use the etymology, not from mar, bitter. Mar, master? I forget what it is, but... Because it's always bugged me, too, that this connection to water, but somehow being bitter, it's always been an interesting juxtaposition for me. But I think, for sure, she's connected to this living symbol of water being, particularly in the Middle East... It is the definitive element that means life. Without it, there is no life. I mean, we know that in general. Like when we're looking in space and looking at all these planets, what's the first question we ask? Is there water? Right? Because there is no life without water of some kind. So we understand that as human beings being of this kind of natural world, we get it that water, we're dependent on water for life. We are mostly water. I mean, I think, you know, we get it on all kinds of levels, but when you live in a desert, when you live in a climate that is, your survival is determined by how much water either falls or is found, there's just a much deeper connection, I think, or awareness of the connection between life and water. And Miriam is the paradigmatic figure for us about
water.
You would never say, you know, to bitterness she brings water. I mean, where there's bitterness, she brings the water.
Right.
That's kind of contorting.
It seems that it might be that there is water that is bitter, like brackish, and there is something you can do to it to make it sweet. So that story we get of Moshe does something to the water my biblical year teacher of blessed memory, Tikva Frymerkensky, said there is a kind of situation with water in the Middle East where if you take a certain plant and put that plant in it, that it chemically changes the water to being sweet and drinkable. I'm just either approaching that age or I'm just really tired this week, but I cannot for the life of me remember. But that's so it might be something like that, like a memory of a bitter water that is made sweet.
And probably only she would know that.
That trick?
Yeah.
It's Moshe who does it in Torah.
Ah, okay.
So but possibly it's women's lore, you know, but he is the agent of that change in Torah. But if we also think about the waters of birth, those waters that are necessary for birthing new life, I mean, it's a bitter experience also. Right? Like that, it's mixed. It's both new life emerging and the pain and danger, particularly in the ancient world, the pain and danger associated with that are very, very real for both mother and infant. So in some ways, bitter waters, if we're talking about birth in some ways, I guess it actually makes some sense. Right? All right, so we get the story of we get the mention of the death of Miriam. Let's go actually back to 2025, because this parsha is kind of loaded with heavy things for the people. So they start complaining that they have no water after the death of Miriam, and we have the incident of Moshe and the rock. Right, this is a doublet. This is a story that was told elsewhere. We're getting a reiteration of that story here in Numbers, where he strikes the rock. In the other story, he talks to it. In this one, he strikes it. Or no, there, whatever. Right, he strikes, and it was okay, because he was supposed to. Here, he was supposed to talk to it, and he hit it. And water came forth, but there was a serious consequence, right, for that. All right, so somebody read it 25. 2025.
Take Aaron and his son Eleazar and bring them up on Mount Hor. Strip Aaron of his vestments and put them on his son Eleazar. There Aaron shall be gathered unto the dead. Moses did as Adonai had commanded. They ascended Mount Hor in the sight of the whole community. Moses stripped Aaron of his vestments and put them on his son Eleazar, and Aaron died there on the summit of the mountain. When Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain, the whole community knew that Aaron had breathed his last. All the house of Israel bewailed Aaron 30 days.
Okay. So, kach et Aharon ve'et Eleazar b'no. So, take Aaron and Eleazar, his son, right? So, for some of us, we can't help but hear the echo of kach et bincha, et yechidcha. Take your son, your only son, right? And you're going to offer him on a mountaintop, right? So if you're kach et and it's a person, take this person, we can't help but hear some of us the resonance. And we read it every Rosh Hashanah, right? So it's very familiar to us. Kach, take Aaron and Eleazar his son. And I do in fact need these. V'ha'al otam ho ha'al, right? And bring them up to this mountain called Hor, right? So it's an interesting name for a mountain. It's almost like the mountain that's called Mount. How do you say mountain in Hebrew?
Har.
Har. So you're going to take them to the Har. It's called Hor, right? Like, so Hor Ha'har. You're going to take them to Hor Ha'har, the mountain. Okay. So take Aaron, meaning you're going to escort Aaron, right? So still this is how we understand a funeral in our tradition. The word for funeral in Hebrew is levaya, which means accompaniment, right? We don't have a word funeral. We have levaya, the accompanying.
That's nice.
So you accompany someone.
A levaya.
Right, so someone dies. In our tradition, someone stays with the body 24/7, and then everyone accompanies the body to its final resting place, that it shouldn't be alone. Until it's in the ground, the body's not left alone, traditionally. Jewish funeral homes, you know, still have someone, a shomer, who sits and recites psalms. 24 hours a day, there's somebody reciting psalms. So this idea is very, very old for us, right? This idea of accompanying somebody. So you're going to take Aaron and Eleazar, his son, because you're going to need to divest Aaron of his sacral vestments, and you're going to have to vest Eleazar. Because what's going to happen when Moshe comes down from the mountain and there's no Aaron? Like, what's the first thing for the people? What is their response going to be?
Bewilderment.
Well, who's going to be?
Bewilderment, lost.
Who's going to be the replacement?
Who's going to be the replacement? Who's going to be the high priest? This is a moment of rabbinic transition, right? I mean, this is, if Moshe comes down alone and there's no high priest, they're going to be bewildered and lost. And what's the last time somebody went up on a mountain and the people were bewildered and lost? What happened then? It was not pretty, right? It was not good what happened then, right? The golden calf happens. So God seems to have learned something about what this people does when there's mountaintop ascension and somebody doesn't come down. Who's supposed to, right? The people go crazy. So possibly this is a loving act of God, right? To say, bring Eleazar, and you're going to vest him up there so that the people don't flip out. They'll still see a high priest coming down the mountain. It just isn't Aaron. It's going to be the son.
Is it possible that this act establishes the family of the descendants of Aaron?
For sure.
The priest.
For sure. Yeah. And maybe, that's a good point, Reuben, and maybe also it's like so that there's no opportunity for that to be challenged. It happens on the mountain. Right? So it isn't like, okay, they come down, there's no Aaron, they have his stuff, and now maybe there's, I've been watching the Borgias.
Ah.
Has anybody seen the Borgias? Gorgeous. Oh my gosh, it's gorgeous. I mean, each episode is a movie, right? It's unbelievable the details. They went to such extraordinary lengths to make every detail authentic. So it's the story of the Borgia Pope, you know, the family Borgia their patriarch is the Pope of Rome. And the whole series is about the intrigue in the Vatican, right? The whole thing is about the intrigue about families fighting to be the next pope. And all the politics of the cardinals and stabbings and poisonings and, you know, and alliances and betrayals and wars and like all this stuff that gets all over who's gonna wear the pontiff's, right? Regalia, all the robes and all the headdress and everything, and the incredible power that symbolizes, right? And the Pope in some ways was more powerful than the king, because the Pope invests the king. You know, like, so there's this idea that the king is nothing without the investiture of the Pope, because the Pope is the direct, right, kind of line to God. And so so there's that moment of, if they come down with the vestments, it's very possible there could have been, right, some serious ugliness around who's going to be the next Kohen Gadol, the next high priest.
And they have to be a democracy and have an election.
And if they're going to be, if all the people are holy and it's going to be a democracy, then there's going to be an election and then there's going to be a campaign.
Right.
That's not going to be pretty. Right? So, and who loses, forget about it. Right? So, nice, Reuben. Very close reading. So that maybe this is it happens on the mountain so that he comes down as high priest and Aaron's succession is assured. The succession of his, what do you call it when it's by genetics?
Dynasty.
His dynasty is.
Progeny.
Yeah, progeny and progenitor is where the kingdom. But I know it's.
But it's when you passed up on through the genes. What's that?
Bloodline.
No, it's not the gene.
It's not like Moses through Joshua. It is
succession.
Is it progeny?
No, it's. What is it when you inherit the power because you were born into it?
Oh, it's, I know that word.
Primogeniture.
No.
Okay, it's,
It's been to sound like me.
Right? It's bad today. What is it? When you, like the kings, if you're, you get it because you're the child of the king.
Right, the first
genitor. You inherit.
But you can inherit without being genetically linked.
Oh, God.
Okay, good. I'm glad it's not just me.
Heir?
No, you can be an heir without being a genetic descendant. What is it called when it's a genial? I mean, it's...
You don't get the job because your dad is the head of the...
Right, because you're born.
Right.
It's through the bloodline. It's no, I'm talking about the system.
Nepotism.
No. No, nepotism is when you choose someone out of your own self-interest over someone who might deserve it. That's nepotism.
Because
your
family. Okay.
No. So this is.
And I don't know what the.
This is in front of all the people.
They see, and it must be pretty dramatic. I mean, Aaron is still alive when he's walking, when they're going up there.
Correct.
Dies up there, so
right.
Yeah. I have a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is a story. It's bothering me.
Yes.
So he's fine. He walks up there, and they just leave him on the mountain to die.
Presumably,
his brother.
Presumably,
and his
no. Presumably, they stay with him until he dies.
Yeah.
So they stay with him until he dies.
Yeah.
That's still, horrendous.
Moshe dies the same way. Moshe dies on a mountain by the kiss of God.
Yeah.
Well, what's horrendous?
That seemed a little different to me.
So what's the difference?
I don't know. It just seemed like the kiss of God, like God kissed Moshe and then,
I'm going to read you. Funny you should bring it up.
Thank you.
By the way,
it's bothering me.
2:00 in the morning, you'll remember.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, I know.
And then I'm going to call
every one of us.
Every single one of you.
I'm trying to Google it. So.
Yes, what's it called? When you inherit because you're... It goes through
the
bloodline. It's
not primogenitor.
No, that's the person. The rule of primogenitor is the first... Son gets everything, or gets more. That's primogenitor.
Oh, it says inheritance of the high priest church.
All right, so I'm going to read you. If you don't know about this, you should. This is called the Book of Legends, which is a Sefer HaAgadah, legends from the Talmud and Midrash. So Chaim Nachman Bialik and Yoshua Chana Ravnitsky scoured the Talmud and the Midrash for stories that were not legal, they weren't legal rulings. It's all of the Agadah, all of the material from the Talmud that is not law. It's not halacha, it's Agadah. And it is in this book, and it is searchable both by scriptural reference and by topic.
Huh.
It exists in Hebrew, and it has been translated into English.
And Bialik was a great poet.
A great poet and a great translator of Agadah.
Didn't know that.
So this is a huge, as you can see, book. And it's fabulous that it's translated into English. So I'm going to read to you Aaron's death so that you can feel better, Carol.
Thank you, because it's bothering me.
When Aaron's time came to depart from this world, the Holy One said to Moses, "Go tell Aaron of his impending death." So Moses rose early in the morning and went to Aaron. As soon as he called out, "Aaron, my brother," Aaron came down and asked, "What made you come here so early today?" Moses replied, "During the night I meditated on a matter in Scripture which I found distressing, and so I rose early and came to you." "What was the matter?" Aaron asked. "I do not remember, but I know it was in the book of Genesis. Bring it, and we'll read it," says Moses. They took the book of Genesis, read each and every section in it, and said about each one of them, "The Holy One wrought well, created well." But when they came to the creation of Adam, Moses asked, "What is one to say of Adam who brought death to the world, so that I who prevailed over the ministering angels and you who held back death are not even you and I to have a like end? After all, how many more years have we to live?" "Not many," Aaron answered. Moses continued talking until finally he mentioned to him the precise day when death was to come. At that moment, Aaron's bones felt the imminence of his own demise. So he asked, "Is it because of me that you found the matter in Scripture so distressing?" Moses answered, "Yes." At once Israel noticed that Aaron's height had diminished. "Even as Aaron said, my heart doth writhe within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me," from Psalms. Moses asked, "Is dying acceptable to you?" "Aaron, yes." "Moses, then let us go up to the mountain, to the top of the mountain." At that, the three, Moses, Aaron, and Eleazar, went up in the sight of all Israel. Had Israel known that Aaron was going up to die, they would not have allowed it, but would have besought mercy on his behalf. However, they thought that the divine word had summoned him. When the three reached the top of the mount, a cave opened for them. In it, they found a burning lamp and a couch, both wrought by heaven. Then Aaron proceeded to remove his garments one by one, and Eleazar donned them, until finally a celestial cloud enveloped Aaron's body. Moses said to Aaron, "Just think, Aaron, my brother, when Miriam died, you and I attended her. Now that you are about to die, I and Eleazar are attending you. But I, when I die, who will attend me?" The Holy One said to Moses, "Bechayecha, as you live, I myself will attend you."
It brings tears to life. It's so poignant.
It's really beautiful. It goes on for a little bit, but this is directly from the Talmud, because the rabbis had the same problem you did, right? Oh, cool. The rabbis had the same problem. It's like, wait a minute, this is Aaron, the high priest. How could it be? They just go up on the mountain and he dies and Eleazar comes down in his clothes. That cannot be all there is to that scene, right? That's just, it distressed the rabbis too greatly, right, to leave it there. So there's this beautiful midrash.
To me, it's a gift that Aaron got to see the transition of power and be there.
To see his son take over. Because what happened to Aaron vis-a-vis sons?
Two of them died.
Two of them died for
being too cheeky, offering strange fire. Maybe they got what they wanted, which is to be really close to God.
Right.
Whatever it was, he watched two of his children in service, in direct service, be immolated, burned alive. Right? So for him, I think in the rabbinic imagination, to see Eleazar dressed in his vestments safely, right, is for them the coup de grace. It's the blessing for Aaron that he sees his son take over and live. Mm-hmm.
Is there a midrash in there about Miriam? Because she had it much less, just one life. And Miriam died and was buried.
Right? The rabbis.
That's even more disturbing to me.
Don't spend nearly the time
around Miriam's death. Right, and 30 days for Aaron.
That's right.
So I have a question.
Well, let her answer that.
So they don't spend. There's one midrash that's very distressing to me, and it's like right after that incident, you know, the people start, you know, the people are going again. And so there's an incident where the Midrash has God say to Moses, like, "Get up and get about your business and quit mourning that dead old woman."
Wow.
So there's actually some Midrash that's not pretty. It's not nice about Miriam.
Do you think that's a gender issue?
I don't know, but I have to think it's something about I think there's something that bugs the rabbis about Miriam being a Neviyah, a prophetess. You know, Moses is a Navi. She has the exact same status. I mean, not status, God forbid, but it's the same word, the same term used of her that's used of Moshe. And I think on some level the rabbis need to
is Midrash,
knock, you know, Miriam down a notch.
Midrash canonized, or can you still, I mean, like, are we making Midrash now?
We are so always making Midrash. When we say the Midrash, we mean generally the body of Midrashic literature that was produced during the period of the rabbis, capital R, right? So Talmud, so the, you know, the kind of the period of the Talmud, and there's more than the Midrash that's in the Talmud, but that's kind of the period we're talking about. It's the rabbinic period, capital R.
And all of that Haggadah, right? I mean,
all of this Haggadah is from the rabbinic period. This is Haggadah.
But this is not canonized.
No. No.
That's the difference.
It's outside the canon. That's what makes it Midrash. And it, in a sense, it's canonized in that it was capped. You know, the Talmud was codified, right? It was sealed. It was edited circa, you know, 600, around 600 or 800 of the Common Era. This was kind of, you know, closed as a body of literature. So that's, we mean from the destruction of the temple to about 1000. That's the rabbinic period, really. Because then you're going into early medieval, which already starts to be, you know, a different kind. But we're still writing Midrash. We're still, Lidrosh simply means to expound, to unpack, right? And so we're, the rabbis say that the Torah is black fire written on white fire. And our job is to read the white spaces, right? You know, we learn the black, and our job forever as a people is to explore the white fire.
They were the priests protecting their patriarchy.
Yes.
And Miriam was a symbol of a pope, well, challenging the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the crux of the whole thing.
I think so. I think she was a serious symbol of women's strength and power. And there was always a competing element of early Israelite experience, which was the goddess. Like, they lost that. When they converted from being Canaanites to being this in this Yahwist religion, they lost the goddess. And some of them never got over that, right? They were never willing to let it go. So we have in Kuntilat Adrud in the south of Sinai, there is a cave where they found a image of a crowned god. And it says, to Yahweh, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, to Yahweh and his consort Asherah. So there was syncretistic worship even in the Yahwist tradition. So my guess is they were constantly fighting against the urge of the people to have their feminine god stuff represented. So if it couldn't be a consort, then it's a Miriam. It's a, right, you know, that constant longing. And we know the prophets, if you read the prophets, they're constantly yelling and screaming about tearing down the Asherahs, right? Which means, why are you yelling and screaming about Christmas trees in the living room unless the people have Christmas trees in the living room, right? So that there wouldn't have been the need for the prophets to keep yelling and screaming about the Asherah unless the people continued to worship Asherah. And in every single period of Israelite occupation of Israel, they have found in every period statues of the female divine. Like, there's no time where there wasn't that.
How is Aviva Zornberg regarded in the Orthodox communities? I mean, I know she comes here, she writes books, but what do they do with her in Israel? I think she has a radio show.
She's,
does she have a congregation? Is she treated with respect?
She's not a rabbi.
She's not?
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. Always thought she was.
Her background is literature. My guess is, and this is just my own, this is not founded on anything other than my own guess and instinct. My bet is she has a photographic memory.
Sure.
So if you read Aviva Zornberg, right, she uses literature as the, you know, container in which to explore ideas found in Torah, and she quotes sources that, I mean, it's so obscure, you know, that she has to have read it somewhere and remembered it, then read this, right, and made that connection, because there's no way you'd read this and then go find that obscure reference in some psychologist writing in 1573. Like, she's amazing that way. So her background really is literature. Yeah. And that whole world of literature. And then she draws beautifully on that to explore. And she has a command of the Midrashic tradition that is really something. My guess is she's not taken very seriously in the Orthodox world because she's not doing what they're interested in.
Which is?
Getting further into their understanding of what God is trying to reveal. Either through halakha or in the agadic portions, you know, what is it we're supposed to take from this in terms of God's revelation. She explores this as literature. So they don't have much use for her, I would imagine.
I wouldn't think they would listen to woman teach Torah.
You know, it's changing slowly. It's changing. Like they are starting to
women at the wall
to ordain women in the Orthodox world as teachers. Not as public congregational presences, because that is considered
talking to the whole congregation.
Unseemly. Right. That is why it's illegal. Yeah. It's not because they're women and can't be a rabbi. It's because it is not sneistic. It is not modest. And therefore, it makes the congregation immodest for a woman to be leading the congregation, a mixed congregation of men and women. But they are starting to recognize women's level of learning as the title rabbi or something like it.
So are they then just teaching other women?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But there are women teachers who, you know, have male Orthodox students, I'm sure. But her whole role is different. She's not going to be the same kind of leader.
Yeah.
Now we need a definition of modest.
Now, well, it's fascinating because that really is the reason that, I mean, that's the reason they use, right? That's the halachic basis for not having women do those things. It's not forbidden. Nowhere is it forbidden, but it's immodest. It's unseemly for the congregation, which is fascinating to me. Okay, so
if I can just close this. These comments on Miriam's, on the status of Miriam. In what I'm reading here, it's sort of like an afterthought, half a dozen words. Miriam died there and was buried there. That's it. And it's on the tail end of a paragraph having to do with not very much. You know, the Israelites arrived someplace.
Right. And we get the status. Normally, how long does someone mourn in the ancient world?
30 days. Isn't that what?
So the immediate period of mourning is 7 days, right? So for Aaron, it's 30 because of his status, right? So it's a huge deal that they mourned him 30 days. They mourned Moses 30 days.
And Miriam.
We get nothing about Miriam.
But you get, and I don't know exactly what happens, the next parts of the Torah after her death, there's a lot of action with Moses and inappropriate action. So you see the consequences, and you're experiencing consequence after her death. You're still getting the impact of her death.
So
they haven't put time
in. It's very interesting. Rabbi Rami Shapiro explains Moshe hitting the rock as being a result of Miriam's death. That he's so caught up in his grief and despair and loneliness for his sister that when the people start to grumble, he absolutely loses it. Like he kind of loses his faith, right? And rather than doing what God asked, which is speak to the rock, he loses it and he hits the rock. So that's exactly where some of the great commentators go is, yes, Moshe is does not do well after Miriam's death in some ways, right? So it's not great action that Moses is associated with right after her death.
I would postulate that his grief is not only for Miriam as a sister, but she really has functioned at a certain point in his life as a substitute mother.
Yes, she's always been, in some ways, his mother, right?
Yeah.
You know, she saved him at the river and presumably, right, stayed with him as that kind of... I mean, if she was old enough to stand at the riverbank and intercede with the daughter of Pharaoh, presumably, she's a good deal older than Moshe. At least, what, 10 years? 12 years? 15 years? Whatever, you know.
Sophisticated.
So she was older by enough that I'm sure she... I mean, think of sisters who have baby brothers 10 years or more younger than them, right? They often are a surrogate mother. They're another mother. Often mom is busy. You know?
I have a brother who's 12 years younger, and he calls me his American mother, and my our mother, his Yiddish mother.
His Yiddish mama, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. There you go. There it is, right? So Miriam for sure functioned as a mother figure to Moshe, for sure.
And just lastly, there's got to be a lot of commentary that all of this portion, we lose Miriam, we lose Aaron, and Moshe finds he's going to die before entering into the Holy Land. What's that all about, this concentrated death of this whole family?
It's pretty intense, right?
Yeah.
We get her death, he's informed he's not going to make it into the Promised Land, and then Aaron dies.
Yeah.
Like, it is intense. Like, it's just a really boom, boom, boom.
Right.
It's kind of. And it's three in a row. It's all three of them.
Yeah.
It's all three of them.
Aaron did not strike the rock. And yet, the same rationale is used for him not being able to see the Promised Land. And that doesn't make a lot of sense.
So where are you locating that?
Well, okay.
See, God says to Moshe and Aaron, because you did not trust me,
right,
and did not affirm my sanctity in the sight of the Israelite people, therefore you shall not lead this congregation into the land that I have given them.
So, I said to Moses and Aaron.
Correct. So the question is, what is the sin for which they are not allowed in? Not everybody says it's the hitting, because you're right. That's only Moshe. So you raise what lots of the commentators do, which is, so it doesn't make sense that the next sentence is, God speaks to Moshe and Aaron and says, because you did not trust me. So what is it referring to?
It's got to be something else.
It's got to be something else. It's not the hitting, say those folk. One answer is, when Moshe and Aaron assembled the congregation, and Moshe says, listen, you rebels, shall we get water from you out of this rock? That's the moment, say some of our commentators. Why?
We.
Oh. You did not trust me enough to affirm my sanctity in the sight of the Israelite people. You said we. Well, y'all are not getting in because y'all didn't do nothing. I did. And if y'all can't, right?
Even the weak.
Affirm my power in front of these people, you are not fit to lead them into the Promised Land.
But it's still Moses who said we.
It's true. It's true. In that case, he got Aaron killed in the desert.
I think it's something else.
Okay.
I think Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam are of that first generation that do not get to enter the Promised Land.
But why?
Because
the first generation of Hebrews,
the
slave mentality, does not get to enter the Promised Land.
Because
Moshe wasn't a slave, which is interesting. Moshe was never a slave.
Yeah, but they're going to new history. This phase is finished.
Yes.
They're going to creating a new people for themselves.
Right. The land and that experience clearly, according to Torah, belongs to the next generation.
Yeah,
clearly. It's
still
very
be
clear.
People that had been slaves that would still be alive that would go.
Presumably no. Presumably they got told your carcasses are going to drop here in the desert.
Wow.
Your children will get in. You will not.
You know, in some ways, the generation that came to this country as adults, like my parents did, could not really take full advantage. They were the sweatshop generation who made it possible for us to go to public universities, but they couldn't.
Right.
So it makes sense.
Right, that Moshe, growing up speaking Egyptian, really, you know, the Egypt experience couldn't translate. Not for the people and not for the leaders. It had to be Joshua and Eleazar. One being a genetic inheritance of authority and one being by charisma, by an indication that God is with them. Right? Moshe chooses Joshua because God says, my spirit is with him, right? Through Aaron, it's going to be genealogical. And there's lovely conversation for the rabbis about how did Moses feel about that, right? That it wasn't his sons who were going to be inheriting his power. And there's really lovely stuff written about because you need both. Aaron was about keeping the system running, tending to the details, and that's something you can teach. You can teach the proper procedures and how to follow them. What you can't teach is the Moses kind of leadership. The Moses leadership is your personality, your desire for this, your abilities, your charisma, your, right? That's something that can't be taught. It can't be passed down from father to son. It has to be, it's innate. It's in you. What's that book? You can't send a duck to eagle school?
To Hebrew school?
You can't send a duck to eagle school.
Or Hebrew school.
Presumably. Although some days,
unless he's very bright,
if you go downstairs, it feels a bit like being pecked to death by ducks. But we are going to go right now to quick chapter 21, because I want to get to the Nechoshet, and then we'll close. So someone read at 21, please.
And the Canaanite king of Arad, who dwelt in the Negev, learned that Israel was coming by the way of Atarim. He engaged Israel in battle and took some of them captive. Then Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if you deliver this people into our hand, we will proscribe their towns. The Lord heeded Israel's plea and delivered up the Canaanites, and they and their cities were proscribed. So that place was called Horma.
Go on.
They set out from Mount Hor by way of the Sea of Reeds to skirt the land of Edom, but the people grew restive on the journey. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why did you make us leave Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread, there's no water. We've come to loathe this miserable food. The Lord set Sarah serpents against the people. They bit the people, and many of the Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, we sinned by speaking against the Lord and against you. Intercede with the Lord to take away the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a seraph figure and mount it on a standard, and if anyone who is bitten looks at it, he shall recover. Moses made a copper serpent and mounted it on a standard. And when anyone was bitten by a serpent, he would look at the copper serpent and recover. The Israelites marched on and encamped at Oboth. They set out from Oboth and encamped at the Ayei Avarim in the desert, bordering on Moab to the east.
All right, let's stop and unpack this business. So, this is an interesting scene here. If we had time, we would spend more time on the beginning of chapter 21, but we don't. So we're going to look at verse 4. That on the way from Mount Hor, where Aaron has just died, right? They're skirting the land of Edom. The people grow restive on the journey, right? On the way. Some want to read this as because of the journey, right? Rashi comments, probably on some unknown Midrashic source, because of the difficulties of the journey. They said, now that we are close enough to enter the land, yet we have to turn back. Just so had our fathers to turn back and detoured in the wilderness 38 years until this day. Consequently, they became dismayed because of the hardships of their journey. So that's Rashi. So whatever the reason, they are really agitated. They're not happy. And what do? They speak by Deber Ha'am Be'Elohim, against Elohim, Uve Moshe, and against Moshe. Lama Ha'elitunu Mi Mitzrayim. Why did y'all bring us up from Mitzrayim, Lamut Bamidbar, to die in the Midbar? Right? There's no Lechem, there's no Mayim. V'nafshenu Katsa Balechem. And our spirits are short with this lechem, with this that's cloquel. I don't know how to translate
that.
This
miserable food is what it says.
Cloquel from light to tree, you know, weightless, something trivial.
Weightless.
It's weightless, yeah. It's trivial, nothing lechem. I think, you know, Melba toast or right? Like
matzah.
Like, you know, ech. With this. So think about how many incidents there's been of this people turning on God and the leadership to say, right? So even in their grief, right, over Aaron's death, they still can't get past, right, their own whatever. And they turn on Moshe and God. Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us? And God's had it. Clearly, God has had it.
Again.
So God...
This is the next generation. This is not the one coming out. This is 38 years later.
The generation that's going to enter.
But they're not the same people. They're not the same mentality.
So not much has changed.
They want to understand, so... Even though it might be a nagging question, there is no God. There's a reason for it.
So say that again? They want to understand.
They are nagging and aren't appreciating God's actions, but it's because they don't understand. I feel, and you know, I'm thinking, well, then how can the speaker or the teacher restate what's to be?
So they do understand
and they can appreciate.
So you have some sympathy for them. That this second generation is going, what's up? We're going
to
die out here?
I don't know if it's sympathy, but they're not understanding.
What are they not understanding?
The value of God's presence and
So they go further than you not understanding. Why did you make us leave Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread and there's no water,
okay.
Right? And we've come to hate this trivial junk you're feeding us.
Okay.
All right, so you're right, they're not appreciative. But is there no water? Didn't we just have God provide them with water just now from a rock? And there's no bread, true, but there's manna. So they're being fed, they're being watered, and they're saying there's no bread, there's no water, we hate the food you're giving up, right? So, and you, why did you bring us out here to kill us? Who said they're going to die? Nobody said they're going to die. Their parents were going to die. Maybe that's what they mean. You're killing our people. Okay? Either way, it's not good. And God sends... Right? Srafim. What is lisrof in Hebrew? To burn. Saaf. Burn. So fiery, if you get fiery translations, that's why. Lisrof is to burn. So, but my text doesn't translate seraph. Does yours?
They sent serpents.
Right. So, because the verb saraf means burn, right? But this says that God sent serafim, like it's a noun, not a verb. Right? Mm-hmm. So it could mean fiery, like deadly. I mean, if you get bitten by a poisonous snake, you might feel like you're on fire, right? So maybe that's what it means, poisonous snakes, burning.
Your skin turns red.
Exactly. We're not sure. But we get seraphim later in the vision of, right, the prophet. So it seems to be a kind of winged, serpent-y, snaky thing that was known in the ancient world.
Is it a kind of angel as well?
So that is what we get in the vision of Ezekiel, is the seraphim are a kind of angel. So it is possible that it was a winged, think dragon that's like a snake, right? So some dragons are serpent-like, right? Like, right? And am I the only one who like knows this? I've been in this business too long.
If the doctors chose the...
That's where we're going. That's exactly where we're going. That's exactly where we're going. Thank you, Reuben. So, in any case, this is what gets sent against the people, right? V'yinashchu et ha'am. So, and they bit the nation, the people. V'yamat am rav mi Yisrael. And a good deal of them, right?
They died.
So then they come to Moshe. V'yomru chatanu. We've sinned. Ki dibarnu b'yudhe vavhe. In that we spoke. Right? And the bet here means, it has to mean against, not in. In doesn't make any sense. But about, you know, in a bad way. Yud hei vav hei uvach. And about you. Right? Against you. Hit palel el yud hei vav hei. Pray to God. Vayaser me aleinu etan nachash. That, like, God should take away from us the nachash. And does Moshe look at them and say, forget you? No, he does not. He's lost his sister. He's lost his brother. They are at him again. God sends seraphim. They say, please, we've sinned. We know we did wrong. Pray for us. And what does Moshe do? Vayit palel Moshe ba'ad ha'am. And Moshe prays on behalf of the people. Vayomer Adonai el Moshe, right? So God says to Moshe, Asel lecha saraf, make for yourself a saraf, v'simoto al nes, and put it on a, what's nes?
It says standard here.
A standard.
A stick.
What do we know the word nes to mean?
Nes.
Nes gadol hayasham.
Oh, a miracle.
A miracle.
A nes.
A nes. Right? So interesting that the word is, right, a pole, a standard, but the word is the same word we use in Rabbinic Hebrew for miracle. Because what happens is, in fact, a sort of nes, right? Because what's going to happen? You're going to put it on this thing, v'haya kol hanashuch v'ra'a oto v'chai. So what is going to happen? Make a seraph, put it on this thing, and anyone who was bitten, if they look at it, they will recover. They'll be okay. Oh, it says they'll live. Actually, that's all it says. We know they're going to be okay, but they're going to live. Vayas Moshe nechash nechoshet. So Moshe makes a nechash, a snake, nechoshet.
Bronze.
Of bronze.
Copper, it says here.
Copper. Okay. So, first of all, he makes a nachash nechoshet. We cannot miss the wordplay in the Hebrew. Just a minute. We can't miss the wordplay in the Hebrew. Nachash nechoshet. But God doesn't say make it out of nechoshet, right? What does God say? Make a saraf. Moshe makes a nachash nechoshet. God says make a saraf. And Moshe makes a snake, a nachash, out of nechoshet.
But they're not going to mess with gold again, right?
Presumably Moshe knows, okay, gold is probably not a great idea, right? Last time we had a gold animal thing, it went very, very badly. So some people say copper, others say bronze. We are dealing with the Bronze Age, so it does seem that they knew about bronze. But some commentators say the only thing that would have imitated a poisonous snake would have been the red color of copper. That would have more likely represented this idea of a poisonous snake, but certainly not gold, like Mickey said. Probably not a good idea.
What difference does it make that it was made in? How is it?
So, just that the commentators are interested that God doesn't tell Moshe what to make it out of, and Moshe makes it out of Nechoshet. So, of course, they read this like a love letter. Why? Well, maybe Moshe thinks, I've got to make it out of something sturdy. Got to make it out of metal. There aren't a lot of trees around. I'm going to make it out of metal. So let's pick the metal that sounds like Nechosh. Yes.
So, I mean, my question is kind of like Mickey's. Isn't this a little bit like worshiping false idols?
Ha. So, it could look a lot like worshiping false idols. How?
You look up at it and you're healed.
You look up at it and you're healed. Okay? So, it could look like they're looking at the snake and the snake somehow affects their healing, that would be idolatry. God forbid. So we're going to look at a commentary that answers exactly that point. And it is very true that poisonous snakes are known in the Sinai. And it is also very true that in the neighboring peoples around early Israel, including Egypt, there are winged seraphim, right? There's this idea of serpent-like winged beings. Some of them are gods. Some of them are just magical beings. Look at the Sphinx sitting at the entrance of every temple or every holy place. There would have been winged, big-time, big old, scary somethings at the door to say, right? Make sure your intentions are appropriate coming in here, right? They're scary. They're meant to be scary. By the same token, this serpent, also, we know that some of the venom from serpents is what's used to heal certain things. So the snake was also a symbol of what it means to die, a certain kind of death, by shedding its skin and coming out the other side of that, a new thing, right?
Resurrection.
It's kind of a symbol of healing by sloughing off that which is dead, that which is no longer useful, and emerging from that process of molting. Or is it molting for a snake?
Yes.
Okay.
It could be, yeah.
I can't think of what it is to inherit through the bloodline, but I know molting. Okay. Go figure. So when a snake molts, right, it's that rejuvenating power that in part makes it this symbol of healing. But even this early, if you're dealing with the bite of a poisonous snake, it seems that the snake comes to be the cure. But it's very clear that they were not to take the seraf itself as the agent of healing, but rather, we're going to look at a commentary that says it was to direct their eyes upward. So lift the nechoshet high, and the people look up. Think of desert sun hitting copper. Look up, right? And you will be chai, alive, kept alive, right? So look up to God, people. You people who continue to take everything for granted and think that, you know, that you did this, lift your eyes up to heaven and get it, that that is where your food, your water, your healing, your everything comes from me. So let's look a little bit at that and then we'll close. I've given you also some stuff on Miriam's well and the cup of Miriam so that you can just tuck it away in your Haggadah so that when Pesach comes, if I forget, you have their instructions for Miriam's cup and how to use Miriam's cup at your Seder. You can find it at ritualwell.org or just do a Google search for Kos Miriam, the cup of Miriam, and you can get lots of lovely different kinds of rituals. So let's look at this business, right, of the Nechoshet.
Are we looking at the...
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm trying to figure out which one to do with you because I don't have time to do both. All right, let's look at the one that says Parshat Chukat.
This is Pasha Kotak also.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? The one that looks like this that doesn't say the well of tradition. It just says that very same snake. All right, Pam, start reading.
The very same snake that makes us so wary is held in high esteem as a symbol of healing. Fear of snakes is one of the most common phobias. One theory is that we are hardwired to be wary of these creatures and spiders too. That's the scientific theory. The religious perspective takes us back to Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. Now the serpent was the shrewdest of all the wild beasts and
that
Lord God had made. Shrewdness is not necessarily a bad trait. That serpent actually provided some accurate and enlightening commentary on God's words. It is how that information was used that provided the problem by demonstrating that a little knowledge is truly a dangerous thing.
All right, so we got a Nahash early in our Torah story, right? We've got the Nahash in the garden. The Nahash was shrewd. It was Arum, right? Naked. Wily. Both. The word means both. That doesn't seem to be the problem. The Nahash actually says some interesting things in Bereishit. The problem is what the human beings did with it. Right? So a little bit of knowledge is a very dangerous thing. The snake represents, right, that power that, when misused, is not a good thing. Hey, even Moses got jittery around snakes, says our commentary. Remember when Moses wanted proof to show the Egyptians that he was sent by God? God said to him, "What is that in your hand?" And he replied, "A rod." And he said, cast it on... And this, I apologize for the God language. It is not mine. It is the commentator who is Rabbi Michal Shekel. So I will try to change it as I read. So God said, cast it on the ground. Moshe cast it on the ground and it became a nahash. And Moses recoiled from it. Then God said to Moses, put out your hand and grasp it by the tail. So Moshe put out his hand and seized it, and it became a rod in his hand, that they may believe that Adonai, the God of their fathers, did appear to you. Well, of course he would recoil from it. Moses was also hardwired to be wary of the danger posed by snakes. So here we get a description of what our thing that just happened. Drop down to below where it says Numbers 21. A seraph is a certain type of winged snake, perhaps similar to a cobra. These creatures appear elsewhere in sacred contexts as slithery servants of the Sovereign One. In Isaiah's vision, the seraphim surround God's throne and declare, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. These serpents are associated with royalty elsewhere in the ancient world. Egypt is the home for images of winged serpents. So what did the people yell and scream about in this episode? What were they yelling about? What were they complaining about?
They wanted to go back.
Why did you bring us out of Egypt? To kill us here. Right? The erect cobra standing on its coil is the symbol of royalty for the pharaoh and the gods of Egyptian history. You are complaining that I brought you out of Egypt to kill you? Guess what, people? Right? I'm going to bring the symbol of pharaoh and Egyptian royalty and Egyptian gods. I'm going to bring it against you, and it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
I didn't kill you. I fed you. I gave you water. I gave you manna. I gave you everything to keep you high. And what do you say? What is the thanks I get for that, says God? Okay, no problem. You're bummed about being brought out of Egypt. All right. I'm going to show you what the agent of death is and what the agent of life is, you ungrateful Israelites. This puts the punishment in perspective. Egypt is not the nostalgic place of Israelite memory. It is the land where the people suffered under the venomous rule of a king whose symbol was a serpent. Mm-hmm. Right? That makes a little more sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Than just kind of this random thing going on, right? Fortunately, the Israelites repent and are healed in a unique way. Right? So we get this whole idea of how they're healed that we already read. Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine, didn't have a medical bag, but he did have a snake. Western medical iconography up until today consists of one or two snakes entwined around a mace. Around a standard, a rod. Exactly what we saw in our Torah portion, yes? One of the most well-known artifacts of the Timna excavations near Eilat is a copper snake, usually taken as a divine symbol. So this idea that they look at the snake and are healed, later in later writings, not in the five books, but later we're told that the king of Israel destroyed the Nechoshet of Moses. Why?
Because it was a false idol.
Because it was getting way too close to idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop using it as the means to look up to the source of healing and start to transfer instead some idea that that's what's causing the healing, big trouble, we're back to an animal made out of gold.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.